Texas secessionists forced Governor Houston from office. They ordered him to vacate the governor's mansion in Austin immediately. Several friends appear to help Governor and Mrs. Houston pack. When they have finished, they're sitting in a candlelit room when there's a knock at the door. Someone answers the door to find himself confronted by a crowd of armed men. But they're not secessionists. They're friends, prepared to restore Governor Houston to power. He speaks to them. "My God, is it possible that all the people have gone mad? Is it possible that my friends would be willing to inaugurate a war that would be infinitely more horrible than the one inaugurated by the secessionists? Do you know, my friends, that the Civil War now being inaugurated will be as horrible as his satanic majesty could desire? And after condemning them for their folly and their crimes, would you be willing to deluge the capital of Texas with the blood of Texans, merely to keep one poor old man in a position for a few days longer, in a position that belongs to the people? No, I say, no. Go tell my deluded friends that I am proud of their friendship, of their love and loyalty, and I hope I may retain them to the end. But say to them that for the sake of humanity and justice, to disperse, to go to their homes, and to conceal from the world that they have been guilty of such an act." And he leaves office and leaves Austin with a little fanfare. The Houstons head east from Austin on their way to Independence. They pass through Brenham. Houston's friends ask him to speak the next day, March 31st, Easter Sunday. The old general's exhausted, but he agrees to speak when he hears angry secessionists yelling they will not allow him to speak. Sam Houston may not want Texas blood shed on his behalf, and he is a man past his prime, but he still has plenty of fight left in him. News spreads quickly throughout the county and beyond, and a wild, unruly crowd gathers in the Washington County Courthouse on Easter Sunday to hear the hero of San Jacinto speak. When Houston enters the courthouse, there are those in the crowd who yell, "Don't let him speak and kill him!" Hugh McIntyre, a wealthy Brenham planter and an ardent secessionist, leaps onto the table and draws his Colt revolver. He shouts, "I and 100 other friends of Governor Houston have invited him to address us, and we will kill the first man who insults or who may in any way attempt to injure him. There is no other man alive who has more right to be heard by the people of Texas. Now, fellow citizens, give him your close attention. And you ruffians, keep quiet or I will kill you." The crowd begrudgingly settles down and Houston begins to speak. He spits words at the crowd in defiance. "The earnest solicitations of my old soldier comrades outweigh my desire to remain silent until the whirlwind of passion and popular clamor has subsided and the voice of reason can be fairly heard. The hiss of the mob and the howls of their jackal leaders cannot deter me nor compel me to take the oath of allegiance to a so-called Confederate government. Its seeds of ruin and decay are the principle of secession, which permits any one or more of the Confederate states to secede from the parent Confederate government. Never will I consent to give up our federal constitution and our union of states for a Confederate constitution and government, whose foundation principles of secession must and will prevent its successful establishment. Or if it should triumph, its triumph would be only temporary, and its short-lived existence end in revolution and ruin. The federal constitution, the federal government, and its starry flag are glorious heritages bequeathed to the South. Our galaxy of Southern presidents cemented the bonds of union between all the states, which can never be broken. Washington declared for an indivisible union, and Jackson made the secession of South Carolina and other states impossible. All our northern presidents have been equally patriotic and just to the South. Not a single Southern right has been violated by any president or by any federal administration. President Lincoln has been elected because the secession Democrats divided the Democratic Party. I believe a large majority of our Southern people are opposed to secession, and if the secession leaders would permit our people to take ample time to consider secession and then hold fair elections, the secession movement would be defeated by an overwhelming majority. In closing, he tells them, "The Civil War, which is now near at hand, will be stubborn and of long duration. The fearful conflict will fill our fair land with untold suffering, misfortune, and disaster. The soil of our beloved South will drink deep the precious blood of our sons and brethren. The die has been cast by your secession leaders." And with that, Sam Houston heads off to the east, to the town of Independence. After a visit, the Houstons continue on to their home at Cedar Point on Galveston Bay. Sam Houston is angry, and for good reason. More than a few newspaper editors have the audacity to brand him a traitor. Brenham was an impromptu occasion. Sam Houston is determined to speak his mind and set the record straight before fading off into obscurity. He chooses to speak at Galveston, the largest city in Texas. He arrives there on April 19, 1861. Just 7 days earlier, secessionists in Charleston, South Carolina, had bombarded Union forces in Fort Sumter with artillery. President Lincoln responded by summoning militia from the states, totaling 75,000 men to put down the rebellion. Texas is at war. Galveston is exposed to attack, and the people are in a frenzy. The mayor and law enforcement in Galveston are not happy with Sam Houston's choice of venue. There is the very real possibility of a riot, if not a lynching. Galvestonians voted overwhelmingly in favor of secession. They previously had destroyed the newspaper office of Der Union, whose publisher Ferdinand Flake had supported Sam Houston and unionism. A small committee meets Sam Houston as he disembarks from the steamboat. It is not a welcoming committee. They urge Houston to turn around and go home. Houston glares at them and barks, "I'm neither a traitor nor a coward. If I turn back now, my enemies will call me both. No, sir, I cannot do that. I have lived in vain, gentlemen, if I cannot now speak what I think. If it has come to that here, I may as well die now as at any time." One of the men, a friend of Houston's, asked the old general if in fact he'd said that Jefferson Davis was a perfidious traitor with ambitions to become dictator. Turning to him with a look of contempt, Houston says, "I did say so, and in the presence of God I think so, and I will say what I think, though the thunders blast me here." As they turn and start to go to the Hurlbut House, where Houston is to speak, one man asks another, "Well, what did you get out of the old man?" And the member of the committee says, "All I got from him was that he is going to say what he damn well pleases." Houston walks to the hall almost unattended. People jeer along the way. On arriving at the hall, he is told that it's closed, the owners fearing its destruction by a mob. The old warrior is spoiling for a fight. Nearby is the Tremont Hotel, which has an external stairway and an elevated balcony overlooking the street. Houston makes his way up the stairs to the elevated balcony. He tells the crowd, "You have always prospered most when you listened to my counsels. I am an old man now. Will you now reject these last counsels of your political father and squander your political patrimony in riotous adventure, which I now tell you, and with something of prophetic ken, will land you in fire and rivers of blood?" Some of you laugh to scorn the idea of bloodshed as a result of secession. But let me tell you what is coming on the heels of secession. The time will come when your fathers and husbands, your sons and brothers, will be herded together like sheep and cattle at the point of bayonet, and your mothers and wives, your sisters and daughters will ask, "Where are they?" And echo will answer, "Where?" You may, after the sacrifice of countless millions of treasure and hundreds of thousands of lives, win Southern independence, if God be not against you. But I doubt it. And the old general heads to Cedar Point. Following the huge losses at the Battle of Shiloh and the realization that the war will not be easily resolved, the Confederate Congress passes the Conscription Act on April 16, 1862, requiring all males between 16 and 35 years of age to report for duty. Less than a week later, General Paul Hebert replaces General Hamilton B. as commander of the Confederacy's Military Department of Texas. General Hamilton B. assumes responsibility for South Texas. On April 24th, General B. declares Texas Hill Country to be an open rebellion against conscription and sends in partisans. On May 30th, 1862, General Hebert declares martial law throughout Texas. He appoints provost marshals to administer conscription, and he gives them full authority to carry out their mission, however they see fit. The absence of any personal freedoms or constitutional rights leads to state-sanctioned terror, war on unionists and deserters in the summer of 1862. Thugs drag unionists from their homes and hang them. Troops hunt down men in hiding. They relentlessly pursue groups of Union men trying to ride out of Texas to safety. On August 9th, 1862, General Sam writes Governor Frank Lubbock, "A proclamation issued by General Hebert in May, and I presume not revoked, is the most extraordinary document I have ever seen, and I venture to say has ever been seen in any country, unless it was one where despotic sway was the only rule of law. In that proclamation, he abrogates all the powers of Your Excellency as governor of the state, ignores the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the laws, and arrogates to himself undefined and unlimited powers. By his proclamation of martial law, he has created provost marshals who are authorized to remove citizens upon suspicion out of the state without trial, and called in the military to aid in the execution of the provost marshal's pleasure or will, and has established an inquisition extending to all male persons over the age of 16. The powers and duties of the provost marshals are not defined in the proclamation. From whence are derived these extraordinary powers? Martial law may be proclaimed and enforced when a city is besieged or a neighborhood, but then the only plea which it can justify is a necessity. Will anyone say that any part of Texas is besieged? The proclamation assumes unlimited power in the military. Summary judgments are to be visited for supposed offenses. Citizens are to be dragged before a military tribunal, condemned and sentenced without a trial by jury, thus trampling underfoot every principle of the Constitution and the laws. Upon information by malignant individuals, men are handcuffed, dragged from their homes, leaving their families unprotected, their property confiscated, and then imprisoned without one charge being established against them by their accusers. All this having been done on information. What benefits are these things to our cause? Are they calculated to advance the cause of Southern independence? The inviolability of the Constitution is the only safeguard to liberty. And when it is disregarded in the Bill of Rights also, there is no limit to the power of one man's will. These summary judgments can be substituted in the place of law." Houston himself clearly feels pressure. He writes the provost marshal of Harris County less than a week later, stating that he has heard that inquiries have been made as to probable witnesses against me. He requests the names of those who had made any charges against my loyalty to the government. In the fall of 1862, General Sam leaves Cedar Point and he moves his wife and children to Huntsville, and they rent a two-story residence known as the Steamboat House. By early 1863, General Sam knows that his days are numbered. He writes out his will at Huntsville on April 2nd. On April 21st, 1863, he writes his good friend E.W. Cave, a Unionist who served under him as Secretary of State, "I suppose you've heard that the federal officers taken to Galveston are ordered to be placed here in the penitentiary. I have not time to assign all my reasons for denouncing it. It is another advance upon states' rights." Houston helps the federal prisoners by arranging conveniences, such as an honor system under which they can attend functions in town. He gets some better accommodations in the prison. There are those who do not take kindly to his friendliness with the Union officers. Most accounts make clear that through his last days in Huntsville, the old general sits on the porch in his rocking chair and periodically walks across the meadow to the penitentiary to visit the United States officers imprisoned there. His last conversations concerning Texas, the war, and the Union are with these federal prisoners. On July 26, 1863, after being ill for several weeks, General Sam succumbs to pneumonia. He's 70 years old. The Union prisoners at the penitentiary have the honor of making the general's coffin. The family and a few close friends pay their last respects and bury the remains of the old general with little ceremony. News of the great Union victories at Gettysburg on July 1st to 3rd, at Vicksburg on the Mississippi River on July 4th, and at Port Hudson, Louisiana on July 9th, have dealt crushing blows to even the most optimistic of Confederate supporters. A dark cloud has descended over Texas. In 1866, Houston's old friend, Unionist George Washington Pascal, publishes an article, "The Last Years of Sam Houston," and he writes, "In June 1863, in the 73rd year of his age, under the dark cloud which overhung his country and family, Sam Houston died and slept with his fathers. Silently and quietly he was buried. A short line in one or two newspapers curtly chronicled the event. The young heroes of the rebellion stopped not to fire a gun, nor to put on a badge of mourning in honor of the fallen champion of liberty, who bore honorable scars from breast to heel, and who in his day made a nation. Let not the young state, which then numbered 1 million souls, be charged with ingratitude. Houston had been too great a rock of antagonism in the way of the dashing waves of revolution, his country. Faults he had, and who has not, but he possessed transcendent virtues. To have loved the Union, living and dying, would cover a multitude of political sins.